This episode of the Rock Solid Podcast is brought to you by BetterHelp Therapy Online.
I want you to want me.
Make me a deal and make it good for me. I won't get full of myself, I can't afford to be. This is small town music, this is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away, a song away, a song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and joining me in the Zoom room today to promote his new book, This Band Has No Past, How Cheap Trick Became Cheap Trick, please welcome author Brian J. Cramp. I call you BJ. How you doing today, BJ?
Hey, I'm good, Pat. It's great to be here. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. First thing out of the box, I have to tell you, the book is fabulous.
Thank you.
There was another Cheap Trick book that came out years and years and years ago called Reputation is a Fragile Thing. And for me, that's always been the Bible for Cheap Trick fans.
Yeah, me too.
But now, wait a minute. We have another Bible. We have the Old Testament and the New Testament. Because this is fantastic. And look, when someone tells me they're going to write a book, or when someone tells me they're going to do anything, I take it with a grain of salt. And I'm a creative person. But I've seen when people try to do stuff and how difficult it is to do stuff. And so when you told me you were going to write a book, whenever that was, I was like, all right, well, you know, fingers crossed. But this, I'm holding it up. This is the real deal. This isn't self-published. This is Jawbone Press.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. You got to be over the moon about this.
Yeah, it's definitely a dream come true. I've always been a big reader of books like this. And I've always been a writer and aspiring writer. And so it's kind of both of my worlds of a writer and a huge music fan coming together and, you know, a book about my favorite band. I mean, yeah, well, what else could you ask for?
What else could you ask for? Now, look, I'm cool in the podcast world, and that's why Jawbone Press sent me two copies that I'm going to give away in conjunction with this episode.
Awesome.
Because I'm the master at getting free stuff. Try to outdo me, people. All right. BJ, this is your first book, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you follow this up? I mean, like you just said, you love to read, you love to write, you love music. This is your favorite band. You get a book deal. This isn't self-published. Tell me about the process of just getting a book deal.
Well, it all came down to, you know, Cheap Talk, and Stephen Roth was a listener of Cheap Talk. And he was the one who recommended that Jawbone might be interested in something like this. And, you know, Jawbone is one of the only publishers that you could work with without an agent. You know, that's the difficult part of getting your foot in the door.
Yeah.
But Jawbone, you know, most publishers won't even talk to you without an agent, but Jawbone will. So that was a huge part of it. And another part was, once I was in contact with Jawbone, I pretty much had a finished draft of the book. So they already knew that there was already something there to work with, although it's a much better book now than it was when I was first pitching at the Jawbone, because once I got a publisher, Bunny and Ken Adamany were much more forthcoming with information, which means so getting a publisher just made it a better book in that way too. Because I think there's a lot more input, especially from Bunny, than I would have had if I self-published. So, and you see all the reviews coming out. So, you know, getting a publisher just helped in a lot of different ways.
Yeah. And I mean, it adds credibility to you as a writer and the book as an entity. I mean, everything about it is great. Like, I don't know what I thought I was going to get in the mail, but it wasn't as great as what I got. And that is not a slight on anyone, but The book is filled with pictures I've never seen before. I didn't think there was going to be any pictures in it. Some are in color and in black and white. The layout's great. You can drop in anywhere, which is, I like that about any rock book. Yeah. You know, you can, I don't like to call it a bathroom book. I don't read in the bathroom. That's gross, but you can just drop in anywhere, you know, read a couple pages, go somewhere else. And you're right. Bunny Carlos is quoted all over this book. Did you conduct those interviews yourself?
Yeah. Yeah. The first time what really expanded the scope of this book was when I got Ken Adamany involved, who was Cheap Trick's manager from the very beginning. And me and Ken went back and forth about having this meeting probably for a year. This is going back to 2017, 2018. And when we finally were going to have this meeting, I was going to meet him at his country club. He actually lives like a half hour away from me. He at one point emailed me. He said, "How would you feel about having Bunny Carlos at the meeting too?" And I was like, "Yeah, I would feel good about that." So, so when I went to this meeting at Ken Adamany's country club, probably in 2018, you know, I walk in the door. Ken's son was waiting outside to meet me. As soon as I walk through the door, straight ahead, I see Bunny Carlos sitting there, and I literally had a 3.5 hour meeting with Ken Adamany and Bunny Carlos, where Bunny I had already sent a list of questions through email. So Bunny came prepared, kind of knew the kind of information I wanted to know about. And, you know, I still have a little handwritten list he put together of years and who was in what band, because, you know, that's one thing I was really trying to nail down with this book, was all these different bands that these guys were playing in together and apart before Cheap Trick. And so he really helped with a lot of that. And, but then that was pretty much all I got from Bunny until the publisher came on board. Then I had maybe 3 or 4 more phone calls with Bunny. Basically, he tried to answer any question I threw at him at that point. You know, when he's told me to send him questions, once I got the publisher, I made a really long list. And then I was trying to pare it down. And finally, I just thought, screw it, I'm just going to send it all.
Yeah.
So I sent him the whole thing, and he just called me up, went down the list and talked about each one. You know, he had less to say about some and more to say about others, and then I would send him more questions and he would call me again. And yeah, I think it was 3 or 4 times we talked on the phone after I got the publisher. So it's been, you know, amazing. And he was a huge help. And Ken Adamany was just a huge contributor to this. He has saved everything. He has all these old letters and documents, and he knows every date they played at which club, which he was a little cagey about giving me his complete list. But if I wanted to confirm something with him, or if I wanted to fill in a hole, because, you know, at one point the book kind of becomes a day by day almost, because I know so many dates they played at the clubs, and it just kind of tracing that trajectory as they build it and build their following, they keep having these flirtations with record labels. All of that, Ken Adamany was such a huge help. I mean, that's why I know so much that I know about the different record labels that were interested and when and who came to see what show. And then I talked to a lot of the guys from those labels that came and saw them. You know, they had a lot of interest before they signed with Epic going back to 75. And a lot of that information comes from Ken Adamany, or he told me which other people to talk to. Like I talked to David Steffen, who worked for A&M, I think. Yeah. And that's a name that Ken gave me. And when I talked to him, he told me the whole story about Jerry Moss, who, you know, told him, "I heard about this band Cheap Trick." Jerry Moss is the M in A&M. He told him, "I want you to go check out this band Cheap Trick," because I think David Steffen was like a Chicago-based guy who worked for A&M. And he told me the whole story about going to see Cheap Trick at the behest of Jerry Moss. And so, you know, those are the great kind of stories that, you know, I never knew that A&M had scouted Cheap Trick, you know?
Yeah, so see, that's cool stuff. Now, let's jump back a little bit. You go to the country club. What are you wearing? What do you wear to the country club?
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah. Yeah. Ken told me at least have a shirt with a collar on it, you know, and this was in the summer. And I think I wore pants when it would have been a short stay and like just a shirt with a collar. Yeah. No t-shirt.
What does Bunny Carlos wear there?
A t-shirt and jeans.
Of course. Okay.
No, yeah, I noticed that Ken had given me the dress code, but obviously that information had to be communicated to Bunny, right, or he ignored it.
Yeah, I'm sure he ignored it. Now, yeah, when you have that meeting, do you record the meeting?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yeah. And actually, there's an episode of Rock and or Roll, my podcast, that came out last week where you can hear some of that.
Oh, neat. That's great.
I made an episode with clips from a lot of my interviews that I did for the book, and Ken and Bunny gave me permission to use, it's about 3 minutes worth. I think I sent it to both of them. They listened and told me it was okay. All right. I definitely don't want to piss either one of them off. So I wasn't going to put any of that out without them approving it, but they both approved it. So it's pretty cool. You can hear how we're sitting there. I just had the recorder in the middle of the table. Bunny's manager was there too. And you hear, it's funny. I hadn't noticed that at the time, but Ken talks over Bunny a lot, and they're kind of competing. You know, they're both telling stories, and it's pretty amazing to hear.
Do you feel like you're friends with Bunny Carlos now? Is Bunny Carlos your friend?
No, I don't feel that way. But Ken Adamanti told me I'm his friend.
All right,
but Bunny, I can email Bunny, and he'll respond. I don't know if that's a friendship.
I mean, that's pretty good. You probably have some friends that don't respond, but if Bunny is.
Right.
Yeah. Before I forget, on Twitter, you can go to @BandHasNoPast. Follow that handle on Twitter. Also, the book right now is on Amazon. You can get it for $17.99. What a bargain. Anything that's $20 or below, that's a sweet ass price point. So buy this book for someone you know is a music fan. Buy this book for someone you know is a Cheap Trick fan. And let's get the word out there on this thing. Come on. We're going to keep talking about the book, but I do want to tell you that the title of this episode today is Cheap Trick, Dirty Dozen Deep Cuts, because we do play music on the show. And so BJ and I have both chosen 6 Cheap Trick songs that we feel are deep cuts and need to get a listen. And it's actually going to be a baker's dozen because BJ also picked our playout song. So there'll be 13 songs today. Okay. Now, BJ, how long did it take you to write the book? Because you just mentioned 2018. That's 4 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. It's about 5 years I've been working on it. But of course, that's not like as if I was working on it Monday through Friday,
right,
8 hours a day. I have a day job and everything else. But you know, it's the research process of old newspapers, magazines. And then I listen to any podcast the guys are on, watched YouTube videos. And then also, you know, I did like 80 interviews. So, and then you compile all the research and then you have to write the book. So yeah, it's a long process. Definitely the kind of thing where there's some point in the middle where you think you're never going to finish it, but like I've said, you get to the top of the mountain, and then once it's downhill, and once I had an actual book that I was just rewriting and tweaking and adding stuff to, then it became a lot of fun. But there were definitely points of despair, you know, over the course of it. But yeah, it was a ton of work, but it's the kind of thing I've always done. I've always been searching for music, reading about music, learning about music. So it's really my hobby anyways.
Right, you know? Right. So it's work, but it's fun work.
Yeah, a lot of it was fun. Yeah. I would say the worst part is transcribing interviews. That part is not fun.
You could employ someone to do that though, if you had.
Yeah. 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 It wasn't in my budget, but yeah.
I forget. You're married.
Yes.
Kids?
Yeah. One daughter.
How old is she?
She's 15. She'll be 16 in what, 3 days?
You didn't want to make $20 or $30 to transcribe these interviews?
Yeah, she would have loved that.
BJ, when this comes in the mail and you open up a box and you hold this for the first time, how did that feel? Because this now it's a reality when you're holding it in your hand. How did you feel?
It was amazing, but it was also weirdly anticlimactic in, you know, sometimes it builds and builds for years to this moment. And then when the moment comes, you're like, I should be more emotional than I am right now. But it's like like I say, if I could go back 20 years and show myself this book, I would completely flip out and probably faint. But once you've gone through the entire process to get there, I guess it loses some of its luster. I mean, it's just been a long, crazy process to get here. But yeah, of course, opening that box was, I mean, it was pretty mind-blowing. But it was, you know, the whole, like you talked about the pictures. I mean, so as I gathered the pictures and then once they sent me the layout, you know, so I had been seeing this thing as it was put together. And yeah, it really seems like I say, if I could just have seen it without having gone through the whole process, it would have completely blown my mind.
Yeah.
You know,
I can imagine. I mean, because it's great. How many times can I say it? It's a great book.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Pat Francis from the Rock Solid Podcast here. And let me just tell you, life doesn't come with a user manual. You know, you get in and out of relationships, or you move to a new city, or you're starting a new job. Sometimes just talking with family and friends doesn't do the trick. So here's what I recommend. Maybe try BetterHelp. BetterHelp therapists are trained to help you figure out the cause of challenging emotions and learn productive coping skills. BetterHelp has connected over 3 million people with licensed therapists. It's convenient, secure, and accessible anywhere, 100% online. You know, you're on vacation, you're on a business trip, and you need to talk to someone. Well, that's where BetterHelp comes in. In a perfect world, everyone would be able to talk openly and honestly with their friends and family about some of the problems they may be experiencing. But we know that isn't always the case, so BetterHelp is a great option. With BetterHelp, you can learn coping skills, self-empowerment, and how to deal with trauma. Again, everyone deserves to feel their best, and BetterHelp makes it easier to get started. As the world's largest therapy service, they've helped put millions of people together with professionally licensed and vetted therapists, available 100% online. All the benefits of in-person therapy, plus it's more convenient, more accessible, and more affordable. All you got to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to match with a therapist. If things aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. It couldn't be simpler. And get this, no waiting rooms, no traffic, no endless searching for the right therapist. If you're stuck, then it's time to get unstuck with BetterHelp. Learn more and save 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/rocksolid. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/rocksolid.
Now back to the show.
All right, let's play a couple tunes, then we'll jump into some more book talk. What is the first deep track from BJ Cramp?
Yeah, and this is a funny one because this is something that I tried to explain in my book, is what is actually the first song on the first Cheap Trick album, because there's actually a debate, right? And well, the first song always was the song that I picked, which is Hot Love. You know, the record cover, you look at the back of the album, it tells you that the Hot Love side is the first side. I mean, anyone would have assumed that. But, you know, I did uncover over the course of the book, and of course, they did that in 1998 when they reissued it. They made Hello Kitties the first song.
Boo.
And I do have proof in my book, basically, of what the intentions were. But how can you ever not think of Hot Love as the first song?
I agree. And that's the way I've always heard the album.
And right.
I'm going to add this to the mix. When you bought the cassette,
mm-hmm.
Hot Love, that side was the one ready to play.
Yeah, I have the original cassette, and it also says side one and side two, because nobody at Epic thought to carry that over to the cassette right. version.
Yeah. So for me, I agree with you. This is my preferred way to listen to the album. Hot Love is my first track.
Yeah. And it's a great opening track, and it's maybe kind of the punkiest song on the record, maybe, or He's a Whore, but oh yeah, it's an amazing song. And it's also, you know, in my book, Jack Douglas talks about his socio-political intentions for the album and stuff like that. Well, this is maybe the one song in the album that is just about girls, you know, and, you know, at Rick's Picks, there was actually, I think I mentioned in the book, there was handwritten lyrics at Rick's Picks that it said, "Hot Love will burn your palms." That was actually written on one of Rick's lyric sheets.
That's
so this is not a socio-political song.
And that sounds like a Rick lyric.
Yes.
All right, let's hear a little bit of it. Hot Love, from the Cheap Trick debut album, self-titled, 1977. Here we go. I tell people this is one of the best debut albums of all time, even though people don't know it the way they know, like, let's say, Boston's first album or The Cars' first album or The Pretenders' first album. But this is right up there with all those albums. And I just don't know why there's not more love from the non-Cheap Trick community. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's a weird album. It's a heavy, raucous, crazy album.
Yep.
But the songs are amazing, and the everything about it is so cool. And yeah, I think it's a Cheap Trick. It stands alone in the Cheap Trick catalog, and it is an album that would probably appeal to a lot of people who might not be that into the rest of Cheap Trick's catalog, really, because it's such a heavy, crazy album. But I absolutely love it.
Yeah, me too. I mean, if you gave this to someone and didn't tell them who it was, they might not even know it was Cheap Trick.
Yeah. Yeah. It was the kind of thing for me where I heard that album later when I had already heard like In Color, Heaven Tonight, Dream Police, stuff like that. And when I heard the first album, it blew my mind. You know, that was the moment they started becoming my favorite band of all time, because I realized there was so much more to Cheap Trick than I really understood. So
yeah, because I think I bought Budokan first and then worked my way backwards. Mm-hmm. So this is probably the last one I bought at that time. And then from then on, day of release, starting with Dream Police. But yeah, just an amazing album. My first song, because I didn't want to pick songs from the albums that you chose, so I went with the other albums. I went with the sophomore album, In Color, and I went with Come On, Come On. Back to book talk. You said you did over 80 interviews for the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there's three people missing.
Yeah.
Who are those people?
Yeah. Rick Nielsen, Tom Peterson, and Robin Zander. Yep.
What's wrong with them?
I don't know. I've tried to figure that out. I don't know if they just think I'm trying to make money off of them, or I'm trying to dig up dirt, or what it is. I really, at the very last second, I tried one last time with Rick. I tried everything. I said, I'll send them the book. I said, what if I only email 5 questions? I tried anything.
Yeah.
You know, did you have Doug Brod on your show, or did you know that book? They just seem a little weird that he had a couple years ago.
No, I don't even know about that book.
Oh, it's about Cheap Trick, Aerosmith, Kiss, and Stars, and kind of the crossover between all those bands. And so those guys wouldn't even talk to Doug. And Doug has like a resume where he worked for Spin, TV Guide, and all these. And Robin and Tom just told him no. And then Rick gave him 1 hour. I couldn't even get an hour from Rick. But they're just not interested in this kind of thing, I guess. And I'm not really sure why. But like I said, it's probably that kind of thing of where, oh, this guy's trying to make money off of us or something. But I have a feeling if and when they see the book, maybe they'll wish they had talked to me. I don't know.
Regret it.
But you know, through my research, through hundreds of different sources, they do tell a lot of the story in their own words, because there's just so many quotes from them that, you know, I did my best to get their perspective in there as much as possible.
See, I would be concerned that if I was Rick or Robin or Tom, and I knew or found out that Bunny was involved, I'd be afraid that he was going to steer the narrative and we wouldn't have our say.
Mm.
How much did Bunny steer the narrative, or was he just being straightforward and factual?
Yeah, I don't think he steered the narrative at all. And, you know, there are things Bunny told me that I've know through my research aren't necessarily accurate. So, he just, you know, he told stories. There's a lot of stories from Bunny, and, you know, he was there, you know, he could talk about Jack Douglas and recording the first album. He could just talk about specific, you know, I asked him about a lot of specifics, but it's not like he had any kind of an agenda or anything. He, you know, Bunny is a huge music fan and like a music history buff. And he's really proud of having been in Cheap Trick. And so I think he would want to know the stories himself about bands he likes.
Right.
So I think he has a good memory. You know, it's like when he was experiencing this, I think he understood how lucky he was. And also he looked at it from a fan's perspective at the same time. So he knows which details a fan would want to know, because he's such a big fan himself.
Right.
And so I think he remembers a lot of that, and he likes to share those kind of stories. But also, you know, just through asking him questions, I've got some really good stuff that he probably never even told anyone before at the same time. So
that's the stuff. That's the stuff right there.
Yeah.
That was one of my questions in doing the research and everything. What was one big thing that you learned that you had not known before, other than the A&M coming after them?
Well, like the way the checkerboard pattern comes into the picture. That's something that, you know, I've said on other interviews, the best questions, a lot of the best questions are the ones you don't even know to ask.
Right.
Because I didn't, when I was talking to Joel Danzig, who was a partner in Hamer Guitars, and he built the 12 string bass, and, you know, he's the guy behind the five neck guitar and Uncle Dick and all that kind of stuff. When I was talking to him, I didn't know what to ask him about the checkerboard pattern, but, you know, he ended up telling me about how, you know, he played a role in Rick Nielsen realizing that the Cheap Trick logo, the black on white, matched up with the checkerboard. So it became like part of that aesthetic. And so that was an amazing feeling when he was talking about that. And I was realizing how important this was. He was just like telling it as an aside, you know? So stuff like that was amazing.
He just throws it out there and you're like, wait, and you grasp onto it.
Yeah, exactly. Terrific. Yeah.
You got some blurbs on the back of the book, which are cool. You got one from Bunny Carlos, one from Ira Robbins, and one from Tom Werman, who for me is the quintessential Cheap Trick producer, because I just love those records that Tom did.
Yeah.
Does Tom say in the book why he never worked with Cheap Trick again?
No. I hadn't really thought about that, or, you know, after him, they had George Martin and then Roy Thomas Baker and Todd Rundgren. And
absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, the Cheap Trick story in the 80s was, you know, Werman, he was really busy in the 80s too.
That's true. With Motley Crue and stuff like that.
But, you know, it's this weird thing where in hindsight, the guys have expressed a lot of displeasure. Well, it's Rick and Tom with the production of In Color, which is a lot of hindsight because, you know, why did they make two more albums with Tom Werman if they were so unhappy with In Color and I Want You to Want Me? Tom Werman is a super nice guy. Tom Werman has gotten a lot of flack from different, you know, Dee Snider talks shit about him. The guys in Motley Crue talk shit about him. So I don't really know what the deal is. He's incredibly nice And he, you know, was very successful in his production career. But then he gets all these people that talk bad about him and say they're not happy with records that he produced that were multi-platinum successes.
Maybe that might have to do with money. Maybe his back end deal on those albums was high. Maybe he makes more money off them than the actual players do. Who knows? Yeah. That's just business.
Yeah. Right. He was also involved with Budokan, I believe, too. Yeah, he was over there in Japan, I think, or he was participating in the recording for Budokan even. So, yeah, I mean, he was, Tom Werman was instrumental in them getting signed to Epic in the first place, you know, because Jack Douglas called him at Epic because he was an A&R guy. Then he came out and saw them, and then he brought his boss out. So before he even produced them, he was a big part of getting them signed and at all.
Yeah. You know what? You never know what's going on. And then did drugs cloud everyone's opinion of things that were actually happening back then? Who knows? All right, let's hit our Dirty Dozen deep cuts. What's your next song for me?
Yeah, my next song. I love this song so much. Rick calls it Cheap Trick Blues, and I'm usually not a blues fan, but Can't Hold On is one of those songs that I think is just the brilliance of Rick Nielsen. It's such a great song. And then of course, Robin Zander delivering on the vocal, but it's just like a hypnotic song that I really just love. And of course it was originally released on Found All the Parts, but it was recorded during those Budokan shows. That version is from that. And I love it so much. And I'm always hoping they're going to play it live. I've seen them do it at least a few times, but it's such a classic.
All right, here it is. Can't Hold On. BJ, to your knowledge, is there a studio version of this song?
No, not from back then. I think they recorded it with Steve Albini. But yeah, not, unfortunately, yeah, I don't think they ever did it in the studio.
They're always threatening that In Color produced by Steve Albini will get an official release. And I've heard it, and I prefer the original In Color myself.
Yeah. What's out there is pretty much the band just playing live in the studio.
Yeah. So what?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
I don't get it.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
My next Dirty Dozen deep cut is from my favorite Cheap Trick album. It's in my top five favorite albums of all time, Heaven Tonight. And this song is called Taking Me Back.
You're taking me back. I remember it well.
barely got into the meat of that song, but man, it's great. I love it.
Yeah, that's an example of Tom Werman's production right there.
Yeah, that jerk. How dare he produce a great song? When you did your research, did you have a research assistant? Or was this all a one-man band?
It was all just me. Yeah. Yeah.
When you tell your wife, hey, honey, I think I'm going to write a book on Cheap Trick, does she glaze over like my wife does when I talk about Doctor Strange or Marvel movies?
Yeah, I'm sure my wife's sick of hearing about Cheap Trick, but she knew what she was getting when she married me. I mean, it's not like I'm any different now than I was then.
That's good. So. I never hit anything either. Like when I met my wife and she came to my apartment I shared with another comedian, and she walked into my bedroom and I had a shelf full of action figures, and that would have been the time to get out.
Yeah.
That would have been the time. So yeah, be yourself, guys. Don't be afraid. Embrace what you like. The foreword for this book is, who's this guy? Some bass player from an underground band called Pearl Jam, Jeff Ament. How did he get involved?
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. Yeah, at some point the publisher asked me who did I think might write the foreword, and I hadn't even given it any thought. And of course the name they floated was Dave Grohl, because I mean, isn't that the only name that anyone ever thinks of for anything?
The only name.
So I was thinking, you know, the first couple of people I thought about, one was Cameron Crowe, because of Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Nice.
And one was Matt Groening. I was like, what if Matt Groening did? So I couldn't figure out how the hell to contact Matt Groening, but my friend Eric had an email address for Cameron. Eric used to do a podcast, and the email address he had ended up being Cameron Crowe's production partner. So I emailed him. He talked to Cameron about it, and he wrote me back, and he said, Cameron said he's too busy. You should ask Jeff. Then my friend Eric also had an email for like a Pearl Jam contact, ended up being Sarah is her name. Because I've never communicated directly with Jeff. It's always just been through Sarah, but so and it was funny because then I was able to say Cameron Crowe said, you know, when I emailed. So Sarah said, I'll put this on Jeff's list of things to consider. And I didn't hear anything for a couple weeks. Then they asked to see the book. I sent the book. Then I didn't hear anything for maybe 2 months. And then all of a sudden I got an email. Jeff wanted to make sure you knew he wants to do it, and he already started working on it. And I had basically given up on it by then. And so that was pretty mind blowing. And then he actually came through with it. You know, the publisher kind of told him what maybe the deadline was, which was pretty weird to give Jeff Ament a deadline, but, but he came through, and yeah, it's amazing. And you know, he wrote Jeremy on a 12 string bass, and you know, he's obviously a huge fan. And, but yeah, I mean, I was obsessed with Pearl Jam in high school, and, you know, I still love their second album Verses, and that's just another surreal part of the whole thing.
It's pretty cool. A guy that you've never met before, and boom, he's written the foreword to your book. Were you worried that if you read the foreword, what if you didn't like it? Could you have rejected it? Could you have said no?
Yeah, I guess that would have been one more thing for me to add to my pile of things to worry about. But luckily, I never thought about that. But yeah, no, I hadn't actually thought about that. But yeah, luckily, it was a really cool forward. He did a great job. And it was funny, you know, he's such a creative guy that what he sent was these like pictures of like this weird typewritten thing that he had done. And, you know, the publisher couldn't actually use exactly what he made, but I was like, can we please try to get it as close to what he did? Because he did this. He didn't just write a foreword. He made a whole art project out of it. So that's why it looks differently. You know, that's why they tried to make it look as close as they could to what Jeff actually sent over. I hope he's happy with it. I haven't really, you know, they sent him a book, and I haven't heard anything.
Well, I bet he loves it. Hopefully you'll hear from him. That would be cool.
Yeah.
How much input did you have with this cover? Because it's perfect. It's got the, without using their logo, it's got the font, it's got some checkerboards here. It's black, white, and red. I just think it's amazing. Like, even you know who the book's about without even reading any of the words. How much input did you have with this?
Yeah, that's a weird thing. It's difficult for someone like me to surrender creative control, but that was, you know, somebody who works for Jawbone who put that together. I guess my main input would be, I came up with that subtitle a long time ago, and my idea always was that it would approximate the logo on the cover, because mm-hmm. it says how Cheap Trick became Cheap Trick, and then you get right. the double Cheap Trick. So that was my concept, and that worked out. And the only other input I had is I got them to change the colors. I think the first one they sent me, This Band Has No Past, was orange.
No.
And then how Cheap Trick became Cheap Trick was white. No. So I got that changed to the white and the red.
Yeah.
That's really the only input I had was the colors, though.
And you're right. It's a tricky little thing when you write the subtitle like that, and you do kind of get the logo without getting the logo. Without.
Yeah, that was my idea with that subtitle.
It's tricky and it's smart.
Yeah.
All right, let's get into some music. Let's go for your third Cheap Trick track. What do you got for me?
Yeah, one of my favorite Cheap Trick albums is One on One, which, you know, it's weird that it was produced by Roy Thomas Baker, but you don't hear a lot of Queen or Cars production on it. It's just kind of this heavy metal punk album. But one real standout deep cut on that album for me is Time Is Running. It's just this punchy song with great melodies. The bridge, I love the bridge. It's a short blast, just a great example of a great, fun Cheap Trick song.
I would tell you before you sent me your list, this was on my list.
Oh,
this,
cool.
This exact song. And I loved One on One when it came out in 1982. And even though it is, but when I saw Roy Thomas Baker's name, I did think it was going to be a sound different than it does, because it's kind of a big, loud, noisy rock and roll album. And you know what? That works. So I here it is. Time Is Running. Minutes and 20 seconds of rock and roll right there. So good.
Love it.
All right, I'm going to move on to the follow-up album with much different production.
Yeah.
Next Position Please, produced by Todd Rundgren. And I don't believe this was released as a single. You can tell me that. That's why I'm calling it a deep cut. Borderline? That wasn't a single.
Yeah, I don't think it was. They played it on that, what's his face from Growing Pains.
Thick of the Night.
Yeah, they played it on his show.
Yeah they did.
Yeah.
So this is Borderline. DJ, what's your opinion of Next Position, Please?
I love it. Borderline's absolutely one of my favorite Cheap Trick songs. And that's another one with an amazing bridge where Rick would write these bridges that really tested the limits of Robin's range. Of course, Robin would pull it off. Yeah, it's weird guitar tone and stuff, but the songs are great. I love that album. It's great.
Yeah, 82 and 83, just so good. You know, I was graduated high school in 82, went to college in 83. And those two albums were just getting so much play from me. No one else in the dorm, but from me.
Yeah.
I go, what are you listening to? they still around. I like Surrender. All right, get out of my room. All right, there. Like I said before, there's many pictures in here. And look, if you've never seen Rick without a hat, in this book, there's tons of pictures. Rick with hair and Rick without a hat. Super cool. How difficult is it to secure the rights to these photos? And how did you find these photos?
Well, a lot of them are from Rich Kwasniewski, who the photographer, who's just been incredibly generous and just let me use anything. He sent me hundreds of pictures. You know, all the ones that were, that there's those two pages where there's a whole bunch of pictures from that photo shoot. They're black and white. Yeah. Those were taken at Rick's dad's store. And, you know, that accordion picture was used. Well, he's holding it on the first album cover, even though from that shoot. But yeah, Rich, and those ones that are at Rockford Armory, the color that those Rich took those. The ones from Summerfest when they were for Peter Frank. Yeah, Rich gave me amazing pictures. And then Bunny gave me some, and Adam Annie gave me some. And then there's a few that are from fans that I had seen posted on Facebook. Like there's that great Polaroid from the Mother's Day show. But yeah, Rich Kwasniewski was so generous and really just told me I could use anything. And it's funny because at some point, Rick Nielsen had asked Rich not to share any pictures of him without a hat. And I remember when I first talked to Rich a couple years ago, he told me that. And so I didn't even think I would get to use those pictures. So I was so relieved when he said, he was just like, screw it, it's history, you know?
Right.
And I think he's just happy to have his work out there. I mean, that photo shoot where they're at the Ralph Nielsen music store, those pictures are amazing. That's why I told the publisher, we got to get all as many of these in as we can. So that was my idea, is, you know, put them all on there. They're kind of small, but there's so many of them and they're so cool. So I just wanted to get a bunch of them in there.
And the quality's great. I mean, it's not like, it's not like the quality has diminished. And you didn't have to pay Rich any money for these?
Nope. He didn't want anything. Amazing. He's great. Yeah.
He should release a photo book, a Cheap Trick photo book, if he has these photos.
Yeah. There's those pictures from that Summerfest show in there. I mean, he sent me at least 100 pictures from that show, probably 200. And he's standing on the side of the stage, took tons of pictures where he's right on, you know, there's only one picture in the book where he's, you know, where the whole band, that was my favorite picture from the whole group, but he's just standing right there on stage with them. And there's so many pictures. And then there's those backstage ones too. You know, there's a great picture. There's even an amazing picture of Bunny that isn't in the book that I love, but Rich, you know, I couldn't thank him enough. I'm thinking about putting out selling some bookmarks with some of his pictures to try to get him some money, because I really appreciate what he did so much.
And what was I going to say about these photos or about Rich? Oh, I just lost my train of thought because I'm looking at these photos and it's just.
Well,
so
also cool. That the ad for Hamer guitars, that Rick was in Guitar Player in 1975. Rich took that picture too. And he gave me an outtake from that. He sent me all the outtakes, but you know, we only got one in the book. Also, I have a blog that I put a lot of that stuff on the blog page too. If you just go to thisbandhasnopast.com, so you can see more of the outtakes from the Guitar Player. You know, that was in October 75 that Rick was in Guitar Player long before anyone outside the Midwest knew who Cheap Trick was. He's in that ad for Hamer Guitars. And Rich Kwasniewski took that picture too. So, you know, Rich is in the book quite a bit because he tells stories from that. Well, I was talking about where the checkerboard pattern enters the picture. It was during that photo shoot for Hamer, for the Hamer ad. And, you know, Rich, he talked to me for the book, told some great stories, and then let me use those pictures. Yeah, I couldn't possibly thank him enough for that.
So he sent you all these pictures. So you still have these on your computer. You're never giving those up. That's amazing.
I've used some of them on the blog because I was, you know, for the last month or two, I've been trying to drum up interest by releasing stuff on the blog. And he told me I had free reign, but I don't want to put out too much of it, right, you know, because But yeah,
it's unbelievable. He's great. Yeah, yeah, unbelievable. Wow. All right. Let's go with more Cheap Trick Dirty Dozen deep cuts. What's next from author Brian J. Cramp? I call him BJ.
Yeah, we could keep moving in through the 80s. We just said songs from One on One and Next Position, Please. Well, the next album is Standing on the Edge, which I love that album too. And I picked, do you think this song is a ballad this time around? It's kind of a little bit.
Yeah, I always thought of this as a ballad. And yeah. This is also one that I would have picked had you not picked it. Because I love this song too.
It's so melodic. You know, it's a amazing song. Do you remember, there's a story in Reputation as a Fragile, I think it's in Reputation as a Fragile Thing, where Rick talks about how you two were at the studio at the same time, and he thinks With or Without You was influenced by this song.
Okay. Wow. Huh. Well, yeah. Let's find out if we can hear it in here.
Right.
This is from Standing on the Edge, produced by Jack Douglas, This Time Around, 1985.
Never look back, but now never lose sight.
Yeah, for me, Standing on the Edge, it's got 10 songs. I like 7 of them, so I guess I give it a 7 out of 10. There's 3 songs I do not like. Do you know what they are?
Yeah, there's She's Got Motion.
Yep, yep.
Rock All Night, maybe?
Yep, that's another one.
What would the other one be?
This one, maybe sometimes I do like it, but I'm not that big a fan of How About You.
Oh, I love that song.
Yeah, that's what I mean. When I say that, a lot of people are like, no, that's a great song. But okay, I'll up it to 8 out of 10 then. You convince me. I'll be wishy-washy. I won't stand my ground. All right, yeah. My next tune, I'm jumping to the 90s. I'm jumping to, because you cover the other 80s album. So I'm jumping ahead to Busted. And one of my favorite songs on Busted, because for me, it sounds like the Beatles, it's Head to Make You Mine.
I had to make you mine.
How do you feel about that song?
It's great. I actually got to see Robin sing that song at one of those solo shows in the Wisconsin Dells a few years ago.
Nice.
Yeah.
How many times do you think you've seen the band, or do you know exactly?
I don't know exactly. It's somewhere between 40 and 50. But if I try to think back and tally it up. Yeah.
That's always the number I give too. Yeah. First time you saw them, when was it?
It was actually Woke Up With a Monster tour. When I was like 20 or something, at Summerfest, and I went, that was the first show. And that I went with my friend Craig, who I've seen Cheap Trick with probably 20 times. You know, I say that in the thank you section of the book. I thank Craig for going to see Cheap Trick with me at least 20 times, because that's usually the only time I see him, you know, in recent years is when we go see Cheap Trick. But, yeah.
And the first time I saw them was, All Shook Up. with Pete Kamita, there's some quotes from Pete in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And Pittsburgh Civic Arena with UFO opened. Great.
Awesome.
Yeah. And I got to see them twice on that tour. And I believe they played 8 or 9 songs off of All Shook Up.
Wow. Right. Yeah.
Because they even played Hude the King. So it was crazy.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I actually found a tape recently of a show I recorded on the 90s when the 97 album had come up. Well, I think it was in 98. And yeah, they played 8 songs from the 97 album at that show too. Yeah. They used to, they don't do that anymore.
No, they would come through LA like, around 97 through 99. They would come through about 4 times a year and, headlining in, small places like, House of Blues and the Roxy, and you would get an amazing set list. I mean, whatever album they are touring with, they would really play like 5 or 6 songs off of that album. It was fantastic. I really,
I was telling John Lamro on The Hustle about how when they became my favorite band, like in the mid 90s, it was like the best time to be a fan because the box set came out. Then they did the 3-night stand. I went to New York and saw them do the first 3 albums. I was at the Silver concert in 99. It was just the 97 album was amazing. And I saw them a lot in that period and they were just on fire.
So good.
Yeah.
So good. So the title of the book, This Band Has No Past. Tell the uninitiated where that comes from.
Yeah. If you look at the inner sleeve of the first album, one side is the logo and the other side is filled with this fake, basically biography that Eric Van Leusbotter, who became a pretty famous writer later on, he wrote this. And the first line of that is This Band Has No Past.
But they do. And we know that because of this book.
Yeah, I like a couple of reviewers have said that I took that as a challenge, that concept, which is I like that. Yeah.
You talk about the Fuse album in here. That's the first album with Rick and Tom. What do you think about that album?
Yeah, it's not really my cup of tea.
No, me neither.
No.
And
there's no indication of what was to come with Cheap Trick.
Not at all. I remember finding it on an import CD and paying way too much for it and then getting home and playing it and being extremely disappointed because I thought there was going to be a little glimmer of Cheap Trick.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting about that album, I talked to Craig Myers, the guitar player, and like he says, Rick Nielsen doesn't play one note of guitar on that record, at least according to Craig, because Rick was the keyboard player. He would play guitar on certain songs when they played live, but in that band, he was mainly the keyboardist because Craig Myers was like this guitar virtuoso. And, I've talked about how Rick Nielsen never really aspired to be a guitar virtuoso like Craig Myers, which I think is one thing that sets Rick and Cheap Trick apart is for Rick, he uses the guitar more as a vehicle for songwriting than, he's never, Craig Myers was an Eric Clapton devotee and stuff like that. So Fuse had a very different vibe, very 60s. They were all teenagers when they made that album too.
Yeah.
So you got to take that into account.
That's true. Yeah. For me, Rick's kind of a sloppy guitar player on stage, to be honest, but
it's part of the charm. Yeah. We were talking about in the 90s, I would spend a lot of the time laughing because Rick was so funny. And I would laugh at how he was just wild on the guitar. And I think that's one. I talk about how I say they were reckless, even fearless in the delivery. It's like that's how the songs are and that's how the shows are. It's like Rick Nielsen doesn't really care. He's 100% himself. He's putting on his kind of a show. And like I say in the book, you either get it or you don't. But if you get it, you really love it.
Yeah. And it's funny. Rick is kind of the front man in a way because he does most of the talking.
Yeah. Yeah. I talk in the book about how when they first got Robin in the band, Rick said he was too conservative and they tried to get another singer, And yeah, Robin was never going to be David Lee Roth. That was just never going to happen. But Rick had all the personality. Rick had no problem really picking up the slack and taking on that front man role. He's very good at it. But that's another very interesting dynamic of Cheap Trick. I mean, I guess, you know, there's always been this kind of synchronicity, or, you know, the great relationship between Cheap Trick and AC/DC. And that's the one other band where you kind of have this, you know, Angus Young, the guitar player, is like completely the focal point. Yep. Even though he doesn't talk, but he really, you know, controls the whole show. He is the show.
He is the show.
That's basically what it was with Rick, too.
Yep. Pretty cool. All right. Back to your list. 1988.
Yeah. Lap of Luxury, you know, it's not a standout album necessarily in their catalog, but the first song on that album is one of my favorite Cheap Trick songs, Let Go. It's so melodic. And, you know, Adrenaline Rush, I love it so much. And I love the, it's got like that sitar almost sounding guitar melody that it's a very Cheap Trick song. You know, it's a pop production, but heavy guitars, amazing melodies. I love Let Go so much.
Now, the intro to Let Go, to me, sounds very much like the Beatles song, If I Needed Someone, from Rubber Soul. Have you ever noticed the similarity?
I don't know if I ever thought that, but yeah, I can see what you're talking about.
I'm going to play a little of the Beatles and then I'll go into Let Go. So this is If I Needed Someone from Rubber Soul. Here we go. And now here's Let Go. See if you feel the similarity. Yeah, I love that song too. Cheap Trick always knew how to open up the album.
Yeah.
Their album openers are very, very strong. So great pick. Great pick.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Where do I jump into now? Oh, I'm jumping into Woke Up With a Monster, 1994. Produced by Ted Templeman. This was kind of like Roy Thomas Baker. I expected something different from Ted Templeman producing Cheap Trick.
Yeah, I actually asked Greg Renoff about that. You know, Greg Renoff wrote with Ted Templeman, wrote his biography. And it seems like Ted is more of an executive producer on the album. Like, it's more one of those things where the band and the engineer really did it and Ted didn't. Ted was like, I think he was maybe head of A&R at Warner Brothers at that time or something. I don't think Ted maybe had a whole lot to do with actually producing the album. So
yeah, disappointing though. I really thought that the band was going to take off again when I saw their own Warner Brothers. I thought, here we go. But I do like a lot of the album, and this is a song I like, a deep cut, Tell Me Everything. Tell Me Everything.
I know the hurt.
right, let's get BJ Cramp's opinion of that tune.
Yeah, that's a great song. And that's a great example of the versatility of Cheap Trick. Like, we've talked about how they have these crazy songs, like the first album in One on One. But that song is just a great pop song with like almost a singer-songwriter kind of feel for the 90s. But yeah, that's a very well-written song, you know?
I love that one. We've been talking about the guys who have produced Cheap Trick. I really liked the work Linda Perry did with them on the song Perfect Stranger. I wish she would have produced an album by them, although that album's great. We'll talk about it. Are there any producers you wish Cheap Trick would have worked with or would work with in the future?
Yeah, I've thought about that. Well, one interesting one is in my book, I talk about how Eddie Kramer wanted to produce them, which would have been interesting. And also there was an idea of working with Jeff Lynne too at one point, which I think that would have worked really well.
Yeah, I do too.
Even in the 90s, you know, it was actually Heaven Tonight where they were communicating with Jeff Lynne about possibly producing. But yeah, if he would have produced, you know, the Warner Brothers album, that could have been really great.
Yeah. Also, let me ask you this. Cheap Trick has been releasing a lot of music recently, which is cool. Do you think they're going to continue? Would there be another Cheap Trick album? Would there be two more?
I think so. They haven't really said a whole lot about it, have they? They had that spurt where they had, well, if you include the Christmas album, they had 4 albums in 5 years, which was pretty crazy. Even though, you know, we've talked about this. We're not huge fans of a couple of those albums necessarily, but they were putting them out pretty regularly. And now there hasn't even been any talk really that I've seen from them about the next one, but hopefully there will, because I loved the last one. So, you know, I think there'll be another one.
I got to tell you, the cover of your book is better than the cover of the last Cheap Trick album.
Yeah. Yeah. When they first sent me that, that was the first thing I saw, was that it looked like the most recent album, which wasn't even that old at the time they first sent me that cover. And I was like, oh, that's kind of too close to there.
This is classy. That's a classy book cover.
Well, and, you know, the guy who designed that, he probably had never even seen the In Another World. They didn't even know. They didn't even know until I told them that it was kind of a similar vibe to the newest album, but
they're not doing their homework, but BJ's keeping them in line.
Yeah.
Other than the other 3 core band members, was there anyone else that you wanted to talk to and were unable to get on board?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of people that I just couldn't find, but Jim Gerling is a guy who has a long history with them, but he was their sound man from like 74 to 70s through 76. So that would have been a huge person to talk to. He was also in a band with Tom Peterson's brother in high school. He was around for everything. And I was in contact with him, but I don't think they parted ways. I think basically what happened was they replaced him as their sound man right before they went national, you know, right before the record came out. And I think I don't want to put words in his mouth, but it seems like he's still not happy about that, because he told me it would be like talking about a divorce or something. So he wouldn't talk to me. You know, okay. I communicated with him, and I know, because like he was their sound guy for almost the whole period I'm writing about of Cheap Trick. So it would have been, and also he was around even before then. So he would have been a huge person to talk to. And also, you know, I'd write about when they were in Philadelphia and the club that they worked at, Rick and Tom both worked at, called Artemis. I played phone take with the guy who owned that place, David Carroll. Talked to him on the phone a couple times. He was kind of hemming and hawing about giving me an interview, and then he passed away like during the process. So those are people I actually had them, you know, was in contact with and couldn't. But then there's just the people that I couldn't find, like the different characters in this story that I would hear their name from somebody, but I was never able to. Well, you know, one really important thing for me was to try to talk about Gary Shooter, who was in Rick Nielsen's first band, and he ended up getting sent to Vietnam. And Vietnam was such a big part of their lives for this period of time, for all these guys of this generation. And I really wished I could tell what happened to Gary, and I was never able to get in contact with like his sister. I've finally found someone who was in a band with him after he got back from Vietnam, and he told me that Gary was at a place called Downey, which was like a basically a mental institution for veterans. And so I was able to kind of tell that story because I thought it was an important story because, you know, it was just a roll of the dice. Gary Shooter was the guy who got, he was in the 101st Airborne. He was in ground combat. You know, he was in the worst of the worst in Vietnam, but it was a roll of the dice that that could have been Rick or Tom or Robin or any of them.
Yeah, really.
So it was, I really wanted to tell that, get that story in there that, that was something that was like Vietnam was a character in this story almost because they were all worried about it. You know, the guy Ron Holm, who I talked to, who was in the band Toast and Jam with Tom and Craig, and basically Toast and Jam is a band that became Fuse, and Ron Holm could have been in that band, but he decided he needed to keep his college career on course because if he screwed up in college because he was playing music full time, he could end up in Vietnam.
Yeah.
So, true. You know, that was part of his decision making of not joining that band was he didn't want to end up screwing up college and end up in Vietnam. So yeah, it was important to me to try to get that in there. And Gary Shooter was the way. And so I wish I could have talked to his sister, but I couldn't ever actually get in touch with her. So,
yeah, that'll keep you studying the threat of going to Vietnam.
Yeah, exactly.
It'll keep your grades up. BJ. If there's a second book in BJ Cramp, what band would be next? If you decided to do this again with another band, do you have a band that's in your second slot?
I'm definitely going to try to do it again. And I was figuring out a list. It's really hard because it has to be something that's possible and something that I'm interested enough in. But one thing that one Hail Mary is that Stephen Roth, who I talked about before, who hooked me up with Jawbone, I had asked him, is there any way we could get a copy of this book to Joe Elliott or the Def Leppard camp? And he had a friend who actually took the book backstage when Def Leppard came to Minneapolis and gave it to Joe. So Joe Elliott has the book, and they put a note in there from me saying, I want to write a similar book about the early years of Def Leppard. I have very little, you know, hope that will actually happen, but what the hell, I gave it a shot. I'm talking to the guys from the Dictators. Do you like the Dictators?
I don't know who that is.
Yeah, they're a New York band. They were part of the CBGB scene. They have had three albums out in the late 70s. Their first album, Go Girl Crazy, is kind of maybe the first punk album. They were very influential on the punk scene, like influential on the Ramones and stuff, but they're also kind of influential on heavy metal too. And so Ross, the Boss, the guitar player from the Dictators, he started Manowar. So my idea is maybe a book about the Dictators and Manowar. But, you know, I'd like to write a book that would sell more copies.
Right.
Another band on my list is Soul Asylum, but that would be another one where if I could get Dave Perner and Dan Murphy maybe to talk to me. So I'm still trying to figure out. I would love to do that.
That would be too. Cool. Definitely. Yeah. What do you have to sell to be successful? How many copies of this thing do we have to move for it to be considered a success by the publisher to where they want to do another book with you? What's a good number? Like, I don't even know. I don't know how.
I don't really know either. Yeah. I don't really know either. Ken Adam, and he told me I'm going to sell 15,000 copies, but I don't know if that's realistic.
You'd be happy with that.
Oh my God, I'd be ecstatic, but yeah.
15,000.
Very happy.
There's so many Cheap Trick fans. Have you been posting on any Cheap Trick boards about this or tweeting at them or anything like that?
I've mainly been using Facebook. You know, I think that's a good place. I figured out the best way to get their attention is pictures they've never seen. And I had some. Especially the picture that Marshall Mintz's daughter sent me, that's what I used. I saved that until release day and then blasted it out there because no one had ever seen it before.
No, so, I had people text me and say, is that really Cheap Trick? I'm like, yeah, look closely. It's them. Check it out.
Yeah.
But yeah,
that was taken by Candy. That picture's taken by Candy, you know, that Oh Candy is about. And his daughter sent it to me and it blew my mind. And so I thought, if I'm going to get people's attention, this is a great way. And so, yeah, I've just been, and like I was talking with Rich Kwasniewski, he's let me, I use a couple of his pictures too. And I do have a Twitter, but I haven't been good about using it. I've really just been blasting it on Facebook. You know, yesterday, Bunny Carlos recommended the book on his page.
Nice. That's good. So,
yeah, that was, I think he sold hundreds of copies in an instant right there. Yeah.
I mean, I'm drawing a blank on who wrote Reputation is a Fragile Thing.
Mike Hayes. He wrote me my first 5-star review on Amazon. He went straight to Amazon and he's a great guy.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, but you were asking about what I would consider a success. And I told Ira Robbins that when he sent me his blurb, I already felt like I was successful. Because I really respect Ira Robbins. I've been Charles R. Press has been very important to me as a music nerd and a record collector. And so when I got that validation from Ira Robbins, that was enough for me to feel like everything was worthwhile, you know?
Yeah, he says, Brian Cramp's amazing forensic investigation into the band's prehistory and early days does for Cheap Trick what Mark Lewinson did for the Beatles. And then he ends his quote with, I thought I knew the story, but I learned a lot. I mean, that's, you can't get better than this.
Yeah.
Just amazing. Yeah. All right, let's move on to a couple more of our Dirty Dozen deep cuts. This will be your last one before we do your playout song. Tell me what you got for me.
Yeah, I love the album Rockford from, is it 2006? That is maybe in my top five. I don't know. It's up there for Cheap Trick albums. I really love that album. And the song If It Takes a Lifetime is an example of just amazing, an amazing pop song from Cheap Trick with huge melodies. And I just love it so much. It's very poppy. I feel really lucky I got to see them do this song live in Naperville, Illinois. I went to this big outdoor show there because I don't think, you know, like we were talking about, they don't really play the stuff off the new albums the way they used to.
No, and they don't play anything off Rockford, really.
I know. It's sad. When that show I saw, they did Welcome to the World and this and probably Perfect Stranger. It was awesome. I feel really lucky I got to see that. I love this song so much.
Yeah, I love this song. I love this album. And
yeah.
Coming off of Special One, which has some good songs, but it's not a great album. This was a revelation. Like, I never thought something this good was going to come out at that time. So,
no other band has put out that good of an album that deep into their career. I don't think. I can't think of.
It's tough. It's tough to think of one.
Yeah.
This is an amazing one. I mean, I was buying this record and giving it to people back then. And this deserves a vinyl release.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the cover is so great. I love the cover. The whole package.
Come on, Record Store Day. Put this on yellow vinyl. It's going to be amazing.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Gatefold it. So cool. Yeah. All right, here it is. If It Takes a Lifetime. So good. BJ, before I play my next song, which is from 2009's The Latest, I want to ask you a question. Do you think it's time for Tom to sing a song again?
it's fine with me. When you got Rob and Xander in the band, I don't know if you need anyone else to sing. Tom's but you know, Tom likes it obviously, and they always give him his spotlight in the live show. And
yeah,
sure, the fans would definitely enjoy it if they if Tom sang another song.
Come on, these newer albums. Why couldn't Tom have one song per album? He's obviously not pushing for it because he's so happy to be back still. But I mean, I'd like a Tom Peterson song on these albums, something fresh that he could sing other than, you know, I Know What I Want.
Oh yeah, you're right. It would be good for the live show too if they would have something new.
Yeah, if they said something new for him.
Yeah.
So,
and it would definitely be a fan pleaser, I think.
It would be. I think so too. People would get excited. And come on, throw Tom a bone. He's doing it. All right. From the latest, which you and I talked about this with Ken Mills. You guys had me on your show. And I'm lukewarm on the album, but again, it has good songs on it. So I love this song, and it's called These Days.
Shines all around me. All I want is to be here with you. This is what I was made for.
EJ Cramp, thoughts on that song?
Yeah, I like it. And I've been thinking as we listen to these songs, like Tell Me Everything and stuff, it's like, what would these songs be without Robin Zander? He's so great. And he really elevates this stuff. They're good songs anyways, but he just elevates it. It's, yeah, he's so important to it.
I mean, you know, like Rick missed some shows recently and Robin Sunfield. I mean, guys have missed shows, but there's never been a show without Robin.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't have Cheap Trick without Robin Zander. Yes, you can't have Cheap Trick without Rick writing these songs back in the day. But as a touring entity, I don't want to show up and Robin's sick and someone else is singing. It's not going to work for me.
No. Yeah, no, you can't replace Robin Zander.
So, there you go.
I would not have been real happy if I had gone to one of those shows without Rick, though. Either that wouldn't really work for me either.
They played out here on August 10th. Luckily, I had COVID, so I couldn't go. But that was one of the shows without Rick. But I had tickets to go, but I couldn't.
I mean, I understand why he sprained his ankle and he couldn't do the shows and they didn't want to cancel him. And I get it. But at the same time, that would be hard for me to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What people fail to realize is when a band cancels a show, they might be able to take that hit monetarily, but your road crew and your lighting people and all those people, it trickles down. They can't be without that money. They need that money to support. So I understand if they soldier on.
Yeah, and, definitely.
You know, people should accept it. But yeah, Rick and Robin, that's the sweet spot. Okay, BJ, I didn't listen to any of the other podcasts you did in promoting your book because I don't like to do that because then it might affect questions I'll ask. But I hope that we covered some different territory than some of the other interviewers did. I'm sure we covered some of the same territory too.
Yeah, I don't think I've repeated myself too much. No, this has been great. Yeah, I feel good about this. I'm pretty hard on myself after most of these interviews.
No,
this is great. Yeah.
Excellent. I had a fun time. And all I want to tell people is, look, this band has no past. How Cheap Trick became Cheap Trick. If you are a Cheap Trick fan, you can't be without this book. You have to have this book. Even if you're not a big reader, just looking at these pictures is going to drive you crazy. You're going to want to read the book. So buy this book, get it for your friends. It's a great Christmas gift, birthday present. it's the real deal. And if I didn't like it, I wouldn't have BJ on, because I wouldn't feel good about that. You know?
Yeah, if you look at that one picture, that's the band Fuse sitting at the Memorial Union Terrace. That picture was a slide that Ken Adamany had. It was just a slide that I took and I got it developed. And that's my favorite picture, I think, in the whole book, because it's so beautiful. You know, Rick and Tom, but it's just, that was a slide that was in a box in his garage that was never, no one's ever, was ever going to see it. You couldn't even really tell what it was until I went and got it developed. And so, you know.
Yeah, I mean.
I love that something like that has been, no, it would have been lost.
Yeah, I've never seen this press photo for Sick Man of Europe. I mean, it's just, it's incredible. I mean, we could talk about this book for hours, but then you wouldn't want to read it. So go get it. Go read it. We want to sell 15,001 copy. That's what we want to do.
Yeah, we want to make Ken write.
I like giving two copies away, but I feel like that's actually taking away from two people that would buy it. So look, buy the book. That's the whole deal. And keep listening to Cheap Trick. So, and how come Brian on the book instead of BJ? You want to be more professional sounding?
Yeah, I guess. It was funny. They when they sent me the first cover, it did say BJ on it. And then I asked them to change it. you know, the first time I ever started going by BJ Krepp was when I made an album. It was based on PJ Harvey. That was like, that's where it, for, I mean, it is my initials, but
right, it is.
When I started doing my podcast, I was going by BJ Kahuna, but then Ken Mills just kept always calling me by my real name, like on podcast and stuff. And then it became convoluted. You know, when I first started going by BJ, it wasn't this kind of universally, you know, term that meant, you know, that way. But people think of, when they hear BJ now, they just think of something else. And yeah, so that's part of the reason I needed to sound more professional. Yeah, well, Brian J. Kramp is a very authorly name.
It really is. It's good.
Well, and also it's funny, in Milwaukee, you know, I'm in Madison, but in Milwaukee, there's a local newscaster named Brian Kramp. He's on TV, and Zeno even thought it was him. So I do also need to kind of differentiate myself from that guy.
You got the J in there.
Yeah.
All right. Brian J. Kramp, BJ, BJ Kahuna. Continued success with this book. Again, if you have any more mock-ups of pictures and little blurbs and ads that you want me to tweet out, I will be happy to do that. I'll tweet it out from my personal Twitter and from the Rock Solid Twitter, because I love Cheap Trick. And I want people to love them as much as you do and as much as I do. And I can't think of a better way to do it than to read This Band Has No Past, How Cheap Trick Became Cheap Trick. So thank you for being here. Again, is there a website we can go to? I guess.
Yeah, there's the blog, and it's thisbandhasnopast.com takes you there. And okay, there's a lot of cool stuff on there. For example, there's the old questionnaire that Rick Nielsen filled out for Ken Adamany in 1967. Ken let me bring the actual real thing, the paper that Rick wrote on. I brought it home and scanned it, and it's on the blog. And it's like asking Rick, you know, what's your favorite magazines? What are your favorite movies? What are your hobbies? And Rick was he like 18 or something when he filled that out in 67? And you can see it on the blog. There's a lot of stuff like that. And there's pictures, and I just released a blog post today about Marshall Mintz, who Old Candy is about. And I had never seen a picture of him until his daughter sent me a picture of him with his camera.
Amazing.
So there's really cool stuff you can see on the blog.
Cool. So everyone go to, say it again.
Thisbandhasnopast.com will take you to the blog.
Cool. And then on Twitter, if you want to follow, give a shout out. If you purchased the book and you want to give it some props, Twitter is @BandHasNoPast. All right. One more song. It's the playout song. But before that, follow us at Rock Solid Show. Go to RockSolidPodcast.com for all things about the show. And if you're so inclined, please support the show via Patreon.com/RockSolidPodcast. That's the way you're going to win two copies of this book. It's for the Patreon people. That's how we do it. So BJ, tell us what the playout song today is going to be.
Well, when their new album came out, In Another World, because I hadn't been a huge fan of the previous two albums, honestly, and I was not really expecting a whole lot. And, well, you know, guess who sent me that? I got to hear it early because my friend Pat Francis sent me that album. And, oh, my God, the title track, there's two versions of it. There's a ballad and an up-tempo one. They're both amazing.
Yep.
But agreed. This, the fast version, Another World Reprise, is one of my favorite Cheap Trick songs. The fact that they're still coming out with a song that I would put on my list of favorite Cheap Trick songs is mind-blowing. I love this song. I love it. It's so great.
All right, everybody. Thank you, BJ Cramp. And everybody, please enjoy Another World Reprise. Thanks, BJ.
Thank you so much, Pat.
Numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on Auto Trader. They're really good at numbers. Auto Trader.